idling terrorist groups control large parts of central and northern Mali, yet French forces have been in this region for nearly a decade. During a recent protest to celebrate the expulsion of the French ambassador in Mali, an activist said French troops should also be expelled.
It's an important step in the fight, but the victory must go all the way. The next step must be the departure of French forces, and then we will start the move towards economic and monetary sovereignty.
Mali has witnessed increased terrorist attacks over the last few years, despite the presence of French forces. So what are these French troops really doing in Mali?
In this part of Mali, the French were there just to cause trouble. I'm going to explain myself here. When the Malians first asked the French to come, they were asking for aircraft support and not a ground support. And this is not me saying it. It is the man who was the minister in charge of sending the documents to the French at the time. There is a video. He clearly explains that they were asking for aircraft support. So France came with its men on the ground to better exploit and cause trouble, just because it is this region of Africa is very rich in terms of resources. Now, regarding ISIS and all the terrorist groups, it seems that they are being defeated now since the army took the power after the second coup.
Over the last few years, France has seen its power and influence declining sharply in West Africa. People in the region are especially furious because they believe that the presence of French forces has led to increased insecurity. A demonstrator speaks here during an anti-France protest in Burkina Faso.
France has to leave, together with its weapons. That's it. That's what we want. We don't need the French army.
Mr. Traoré, now do the events in Mali indicate that France is losing its grip on West Africa, a region considered a backyard for Paris for decades?
Definitely, yes, I think that this is the beginning of the end for France. It is the decline of France, and this is part of what some call the big replacement. The big replacement is not only in, let's say, in Europe, but it is also regarding the rich countries, poor countries, and the African continent. Okay, so what I see now, if you exploit people for a long time, if you dominate them in terms of culture, in terms of, let's say, technology, if they learn about your language, if they learn about your technology, if they learn about your culture, and they have the same diplomas as you, but they keep their own tradition, own rules, own knowledge, they are going to be stronger than you. And this is what is happening to France.
Well, thanks a lot, Mr. Traoré, for your insight. No doubt, Africa is rising, and former colonial powers are apparently not ready to face the fact. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, our guest here in the studio will talk about efforts to boost trade between Africa and Iran.
Boosting Iran-Africa trade.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Iran has reported a major surge in non-oil exports to Africa in the 9 months to December 2021. Now, to discuss efforts to boost trade ties between Africa and Iran, we have in our studio today Mr. Mohammed Hashemi Fard, an international trade expert. Now, but before we go to our interview, let's see what the statistics have to say.
Iran's Trade Promotion Organization says Iranian exports to African countries had reached a total of $912 million between March and December last year, up 199% from the similar period in 2020. Iran also plans to encourage more imports from Africa, which remain low at $40 million over the 9 months to late December 2021.
Welcome back. And as I told you, in the studio here, we have Mr. Mohammed Hashemi Fard, an international trade expert. Thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, first, can you tell us what is the level of trade between Iran and Africa currently?
At the present time, this is not as much as good. And we have a very, very good potential, and we hope to increase our relationship, commercial relationship, and industrial in the different fields between Iran and Africa, because Iran has a very great potential to expand and to develop its relationship with the African countries.
As we heard in the statistics, the trade between Iran and Africa has increased over the last 9 months.
Yes.
Now, what products are being exported to Africa? What is attractive to the African market from Iran?
In different categories, like home appliances, like agricultural machinery and tools, like building materials and constructive materials, like petroleum materials, and also engineering service and human service, which is very, very important to export from Iran to African countries.
Yeah, and according to the statistics which we just heard, the current balance of trade between Iran and Africa is in favor of Iran. So what efforts are there to ensure that there is an exchange from both sides? There's a balance of trade. Iran buys more from Africa just as Iran sells more to Africa.
To make a better balance between Iran and Africa, I think we have to concentrate on what African countries separately have to offer. For example, what Ethiopia has to produce and export is different than Kenya or Tanzania or other countries. We have to list the potential of their those countries and to know exactly what we need. For example, some of African countries, they have the oil.
Yeah.
But we are exporters of the oil, so we cannot import it. But we have to, I think, import the raw material.
Yeah.
Raw material and some wood, I think, and agricultural material to use it in Iranian production line in industries.
And meat products, I think, and also coffee and tea also from Africa.
Exactly. We are right now importing the coffee and meats. But about the meats, they have some points that we have to negotiate with the African departments and governments to solve that points to be able to import the meats in different types of the meats from African countries to Iran.
So we expect to see growth of our products from Africa to Iran in the near future.
Of course.
I think that should be the target.
It is very important, and the Iranian government at the present time has a very good program to increase its relationship and to make it deeper and deeper with the relation between Iran and Africa, to develop the relation between Iran and them. But it is based on win-win
situation
between Iran and others.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, several meetings and conferences have been held to discuss business opportunities between Iran and Africa. One such forum was recently held here in Tehran with special focus on boosting trade ties between Iran and the East Africa region. We attended the conference and talked to some of the participants. Let's take a look.
Like we have always said, Iran has great capacities in machinery, technology which Africa can benefit from. Africa, we have a lot of resources untapped, which Nigeria and African countries can benefit from the experience and expertise and the technology of Iran, both in the mineral resources and in gas and oil and gas sectors. Nigeria and Africa can benefit from Iran. And, you know, Nigeria is a very large country. We have over 200 million people. And Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa. So collaboration between Nigeria and Iran will boost development in the two countries. We learn from Iran. Iran can invest in Nigeria, and Nigerian investors can also come to Iran and invest, especially in the gas and oil industries.
Iran is one of the main producer of finished products, machinery.
Yeah.
Also, the African businessman can export fruits, raw material, and meat also to Iran. There is many needs for agriculture product and agriculture fruit in Iran. Mm-hmm. Also, there is a good opportunity for Iranian to go in area of engineering services in Africa. Africa infrastructure in Africa developing very fast, and many countries invest in infrastructure. That's a good opportunity for Iranian to go out and collaborate with the African in this area.
Welcome back to the studio. We have with us here Mr. Hashim Ifad, an international trade expert, and you're discussing about boosting of trade ties between Iran and Africa. Now, Mr. Hashim Ifad, as we know, compared to other regional powers who have a presence in Africa, such as Turkey and India, Iran has much more to offer, yet its presence in Africa is weak. Now, what are you doing to make sure that Iran has a stronger presence in Africa in terms of trade and business?
We have to make a new plan, a new strategy to empower our presence in Africa.
Yeah.
What we have done in Africa before, it was not as great as what we can do.
Yeah.
And at the present time, for your more information, Iran is like a factory for the Middle East and African countries.
Exactly.
So we have to exactly represent our facility, our technology, our power in these countries and this continental, this great continental. Mm-hmm. And the new government of Iran has started to plan for its new presence in the deeper vision. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be very, very good for the both sides to have a better presence in African countries, which we will do it, inshallah.
Now, as we know, apart from manufactured goods, Iran has also expertise in engineering services.
Yes.
And Iran is almost self-sufficient in the engineering services in this country. Now, what efforts are being made to transfer these expertise to African countries?
In the different types of the engineering, we have the power, we have the technology, and we have the know-how.
Yeah.
This is very important.
Exactly.
Right now, we are not a country which is not able to export its facility, its technology, its knowledge, and its know-how to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
If we increase our relationship between Iran and Africa, I'm sure, and we are sure, that Iran can cover a very great African projects in the very, very high quality
projects.
And the constructive and the other technical items and projective and in industrial, which is exactly one of the Iranian power. And we have to start to increase our relationship and our presence in this field too.
Now, in terms of technology, Iran has established a House of Innovation and Technology in Nairobi.
Yes.
I mean, this is a very great move. Now, how is this being replicated in other African countries? And do you have a plan to establish more such innovation centers in other African countries? Because I think Africa needs technology now.
At the present time, we have to have a very great look and deep look for the future.
Yeah.
All the future relationship in the market
yeah.
is based on technology. Is based on innovation,
yeah.
is based on a strategy which is based on technology and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is one of the leader countries
yeah.
in the world which is exactly concentrated on the technology and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have opened our showroom and our center in Nairobi
yeah.
for this one and for this purpose. And we can expose and we can introduce our power, our facilities, and our energy, and our technology, and knowledge,
yeah.
and know-how to other African countries via this great center.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hashemi Fahd, for your insight. But unfortunately, our time is up for today. But we'll keep talking about this subject in future, and we shall invite you.
Thank you so much for your invitation.
You're welcome. Now, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. As always, it was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Imagine my surprise when, on 6th of January 2017, I found out that I had received one electoral vote to be Vice President of the United States, an office for which I was not a candidate, from a faithless elector from the state of Washington. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by Susan Collins, a Republican senator from Maine. She is currently leading a bipartisan group of senators who are working to reform the Electoral Count Act. The piece is titled, Our Democracy Shouldn't Rest on a Rickety Law, and it has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. Imagine my surprise when on 6th of January 2017, I found out that I had received one electoral vote to be Vice President of the United States, an office for which I was not a candidate, from a faithless elector in the state of Washington. 4 years later, on 6th of January 2021, when a violent mob overran the Capitol, I realized that my unearned vote in the Electoral College was not amusing. This seemingly innocuous vote was an indication that our system of counting and certifying votes for president and vice president had deep and serious structural problems. These unfortunate flaws are codified in the Electoral Count Act, which guides the implementation of part of the presidential election process included in the Constitution. This 1887 law, vaguely written in inaccessible language of a different era, was intended to restrain Congress, but in practice it has had the unintended effect of creating ambiguities that could potentially be used to expand the role of Congress and the Vice President in ways that are contrary to the Constitution. Despite its defects, the law was not an issue for more than a century because of the restraint of the people who exercised the serious but limited constitutional responsibility of counting the votes. Vice presidents and congresses sustained the will of the people, even when they did not like the result. For example, we saw this back in 1961 and again in 2001, when Vice Presidents Richard Nixon and Al Gore presided in a fair and dignified manner over the counting of the electoral votes, despite having lost close elections for president. Vice President Al Gore even refused to hear Democratic objectors who were trying to make him president. Then came the election of 2020. President Donald Trump and his allies both exploited the weaknesses of the law and ignored the language of the Constitution. Mr. Trump argued that the vice president could overturn the election results. A violent mob temporarily halted the electoral count that would confirm President Biden's victory. Vice President Mike Pence's courage and integrity on that day cannot be overstated. He stood up to a determined president who relentlessly pressured him to swing the election his way. And he refused to be intimidated by rioters who assaulted police officers, swarmed the Capitol, and chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." As the dangerous mob neared the Senate chambers, the vice president and senators had to be whisked away. The House, too, was forced to evacuate, bringing the electoral count to a halt. How well I remember a sparse group of Capitol Police officers urging us to run, run, as we made our way to a secure location, while other members of the overwhelmed Capitol Police battled the mob. For hours, we watched on television as rioters broke into the Senate chamber and rummaged through our desks. Finally, senators were told it was safe enough for us to proceed back to the chamber, which all of us were determined to do so that we could resume the counting of the votes. The walk back that evening was very different. In contrast to the small number of police officers guiding our evacuation from the Senate chamber, FBI tactical teams with riot gear, National Guard members and police officers lined our route. Vice President Mike Pence and the Congress returned to the Capitol that night and completed the final constitutionally mandated step before the inauguration of a new president. We counted the votes. That day reminded us that there is nothing more essential to the survival of a democracy than the orderly transfer of power, and there is nothing more essential to the orderly transfer of power than clear rules for effecting it. We should not depend on the fidelity and resolve of vice presidents to follow the intent of these rules. The law should be crystal clear on the parameters of the vice president's power and consistent with the very limited role set forth in the Constitution. Vice President Mike Pence's actions on 6th of January were heroic, but the peaceful transfer of power shouldn't require heroes. Much debate has focused recently on the casting of ballots. Much more attention must be paid to the counting and certifying of votes. Our democracy depends on it. To prevent the subversion of the electoral process, Congress must reform the Electoral Count Act. A bipartisan group of 16 senators is currently working to do just that. The ambiguously phrased electoral count act must be amended to make absolutely clear that a vice president cannot manipulate or ignore electoral votes as he or she presides over this joint session of Congress. But other flaws in the law must also be remedied. For instance, the law's threshold for triggering a challenge to the results of a state is far too low. Only one representative and one senator are required to object to a state's electors. In the past, members on both sides of the aisle have challenged the vote without any real evidence of wrongdoing. Our group of senators shares a vision of drafting legislation to ensure the integrity of our elections and public confidence in the results. We want a bill that will be considered by committees, debated on the Senate floor, garner the support of the Senate's two leaders, and pass the Senate with 60 or more votes. The broader we cast our net, however, the more difficult it will be to achieve consensus. We have to be careful about expanding a reform bill to include provisions that go well beyond correcting the current law, strengthening election security, and protecting poll workers from threats of violence. Relitigating bills that have already been rejected won't get us to the finish line. Our primary focus must be on avoiding another 6th of January by reforming the Electoral Count Act. This is the vital goal in itself. It is our duty to get it done, and it is a worthy mission that should not be derailed by good faith, but ultimately partisan provisions. We do not know if we will succeed, but we are trying to fix a serious problem. The senators working on this legislation have philosophical, regional, and political differences. When we disagree, we attempt to persuade one another. We cajole, we haggle, and even argue, but we do so with an eye on a common goal. That is the way it's supposed to work in a democracy. Maybe we could refer to the process as legitimate political discourse.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, treating poverty. Teaching people to believe truly that provision comes from Allah and that He is the provider, Ar-Razzaq, and every calamity that Allah decrees is for a reason, and that the poor Muslim should be patient in bearing his calamity and strive to relieve himself and his family of poverty. Allah says, "Verily, Allah is the all-provider, owner of power, the most strong." This is chapter 51, verse number 58. Then another place Allah says, "And no moving or living creature is there on earth, but its provision is due from Allah. And He knows its dwelling place and its deposit in the uterus or grave." Then Allah says, "He it is who has made the earth subservient to you, that is, easy for you to walk, to live, and to do agriculture on it. So walk in the path thereof and eat of His provision, and to Him will be the resurrection." This is chapter 67, verse number 15. Brothers and sisters, we need to realize that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in charge. We need to do the needful, we need to make an effort, and we need to fulfill our responsibility. But in reality, it's Allah who provides us with sustenance. It's not our efforts alone. It's not our struggles alone. It's not our academics alone. It's not my job. It's not my paycheck. Allah is the one who provides the provisions to all the creatures and not just to human beings. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing treating poverty, and we said reliance on Allah and knowing in reality that if we fulfill our responsibility, Allah will take care of us. This is what we are discussing. Now, Allah has granted the poor a share of Islamic taxes, which is to be given to the poor to keep and is to be given until he becomes independent of means and is no longer poor. Generally speaking, it's the responsibility of an Islamic government, of an Islamic system, to collect those taxes and disperse them and distribute them amongst the needy and the poor and the less fortunate people who deserve that help. O you who believe, fear Allah and give up what remains due to you from riba, from now onwards, if you are really believers. The Muslim knows that poverty and richness and whether things are given to one or withheld are all subject to decree of Allah. So he bears hardships with patience when they come, and he thanks Allah, may he be exalted, for good times when he finds them. But he is required to work and seek to earn a living so as to relieve himself and his family of poverty. But if someone is unable to do that because of health reasons or problems in his land, then Islam relieves him of poverty by means of Islamic taxes and charity that are given by the rich. This is the share of their wealth that the poor are entitled to. This is what Islam proposes. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and two of his children had sought to block New York Attorney General Letitia James from interviewing them under oath. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protest, and William Rashbaum. The piece is titled, New York Attorney General Can Question Trump and Two Children, Judge Rules. Stay with us for more. New York Attorney General can question Donald J. Trump and two of his adult children under oath as part of a civil inquiry into his business practices. A judge ruled on Thursday, 17th of February, the latest in a string of legal defeats Donald Trump has suffered since leaving office. The ruling came just 3 days after a court filing by the Attorney General, Letitia James, in the same matter revealed that Mr. Trump's long-time accounting firm had cut ties with him and had essentially retracted a decade's worth of his financial statements. Letitia James's inquiry and a parallel criminal investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney are both examining whether Donald Trump used those statements to improperly inflate the value of his assets so he could receive favorable loans. Lawyers for the Trump family had sought to prohibit Letitia James, a Democrat, from interviewing Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump. They had argued that Ms. James was politically biased against Donald Trump and was inappropriately using her civil inquiry to aid the district attorney's criminal investigation, which she's also participating in. But in a written ruling, the judge, Arthur N. Goron, dismissed that point, saying it completely misses the mark. After dismantling several other arguments, he concluded that Ms. James had uncovered copious evidence of possible financial fraud, evidence that entitled her to question the Trump family. She has the clear right to do so, the judge wrote, ordering that Mr. Trump and his son and daughter face questioning in the next 3 weeks. Thursday's ruling was the latest in a notable legal losing streak for Donald Trump, which has included several rebukes from the United States Supreme Court. Since he left office, Mr. Trump has lost the battle to withhold his financial records from the Manhattan District Attorney, to block a congressional committee from inspecting his White House records as part of an investigation into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol, and to appeal the results of the 2020 presidential election. For Mr. Trump, the fallout from some of these decisions could be significant, exposing him to civil and criminal liability, as he has come under investigation from at least three prosecutors, in addition to Letitia James. Not only are the authorities in New York scrutinizing Mr. Trump, the district attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, has convened a grand jury as part of an investigation into the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. Today, justice prevailed, Letitia James said in a statement, adding, "No one is above the law." In a rambling statement released on Thursday evening, 17th of February, Donald Trump blasted the decision and attacked Letitia James, Hillary Clinton, and the media. "It is a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in history," he said, adding, "I can't get a fair hearing in New York because of the hatred of me by judges and the judiciary." He has previously denied all wrongdoing. "The entire system is corrupt," a spokeswoman for the Trump Organization said. The ruling does not mean that Letitia James will automatically receive the answers that she is seeking. Donald Trump and his children can invoke their constitutional right not to incriminate themselves, as Mr. Trump's other adult son, Eric Trump, did when questioned by the Attorney General's office back in October of 2020. The Trump family also intends to appeal the decision, according to the spokeswoman. The judge's decision followed a fiery virtual hearing in State Supreme Court in Manhattan on Thursday, during which lawyers for Mr. Trump and the Attorney General made their cases. Several times Mr. Trump's lawyers became so heated that Justice Engoron and his law clerk had to call for a timeout, raising their hands in the shape of a T, a gesture more often seen at a sporting event than in a courtroom. Although Letitia James signaled in court papers that she had amassed significant evidence against Donald Trump's family business, she has accused the Trump Organization of engaging in fraudulent or misleading practices. She has said that she needs to question Donald Trump and his children before determining her next move. Mr. Trump and his children sought to block the questioning, and Letitia James responded in a court filing last month, arguing that there was heightened need for testimony from the three family members. She said that by questioning them, she would be able to determine who was responsible for the misstatements and omissions that the company made in its financial documents. Because Letitia James's inquiry is civil, she cannot bring criminal charges. If she finds evidence of wrongdoing, she can file a lawsuit against Mr. Trump, his company, or others involved in the business. In last month's filing, Letitia James said that her lawyers had not yet reached a final decision on a lawsuit, but argued that the grounds for conducting the investigation are beyond reproach. On Monday, 14th of February, Letitia James released a letter in which Mr. Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, declared that Mr. Trump's financial statements from 2011 to 2020 were not reliable. Mr. Trump provided those financial statements, which include various disclaimers noting that they are unaudited, to his lenders and at least to one insurance company. They are central to both the civil and criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. Mazars USA said in a letter that it had not, as a whole, found material discrepancies between the information the Trump Organization provided and the actual value of Mr. Trump's assets, something that Mr. Trump's lawyers asserted had effectively rendered the civil and criminal investigations moot. But Justice Engoron scoffed at the argument, likening it to the dystopian slogans like "War is Peace" in George Orwell's 1984, to Lewis Carroll's inverse meanings in Through the Looking Glass, and to the former senior Trump adviser Kellyanne Conway's Alternative Facts, suggesting that the Mazars red flag warning about the financial statements made the investigations moot, the judge wrote, is as audacious as it is preposterous. The criminal investigation, which is similarly focused on whether Donald Trump used those statements to mislead his lenders about the value of his hotels, golf clubs and other properties, is being led by Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan district attorney who inherited it when he took office in January. Last year, under Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance Jr., Manhattan prosecutors separately indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing them of conducting a years-long scheme to evade taxes by compensating employees with special off-the-books benefits such as apartment rentals and luxury cars. Mr. Trump's lawyer said that the criminal inquiry, which also involves investigators from Letitia James's office, would improperly benefit if the Attorney General's office questioned Mr. Trump and his children in the civil inquiry. They argued that Letitia James would be able to obtain information that would be valuable to the criminal investigation without having to provide the family members the immunity that they would receive were they to testify in front of a criminal grand jury. Under New York law, witnesses who appear before the grand jury receive immunity from prosecution on the subject of their testimony. After maintaining a neutral posture during the hearing, Justice Engoron was blunt in his ruling, which also directed the former president to provide the Attorney General with documents she sought in her subpoena. Addressing the argument that Letitia James was improperly using the civil investigation to bolster the criminal inquiry, he noted that the Trumps had not been asked to appear before a grand jury. He was also unconvinced by the argument that Letitia James was politically biased, which Mr. Trump's lawyers advanced by citing statements that the Attorney General had made while campaigning, including her promise to use every area of the law to investigate Mr. Trump, who was then still in office. Justice Engoron said that Letitia James had the right to say whatever she liked about Mr. Trump while running for office, and that there was a clear basis for her investigation.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
There is an important point here. This revolution did not come into being with a coup. It did not come into being with a military move like some revolutions wherein military officers took a government and replaced it with another one. This was not the case with our revolution. This revolution came into being through the people. It came into being with the people's determination, revolutionary power, and faith. And it defended itself, survived, and grew roots with equal power. It was the people who did not show fear. It was the dear people of Iran who showed resistance and embodied this holy ayah and verse. Those to whom the people said, "Surely men have gathered against you. Therefore, fear them." But this increased their faith, and they said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and most excellent is the protector." Holy Quran, chapter 3, verse 173. We used to be threatened all the time.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They, the oppressors, were relentlessly stating that they would attack and impose sanctions on us. Nevertheless, the people did not show fear in the face of threats, nor did they become intimidated and crippled by sanctions. They continued the movement in a fearless and courageous and dignified manner. This reaction of the people should be used as an example from now on. Our people, individuals from different social and ethnic backgrounds, our youth, our clergy, our business people, our academia, our researchers, our officials, our executive officials, and our representative in the Majlis or Parliament should remain revolutionaries and move forward in a revolutionary manner. Later on, I will refer to a number of criteria and standards in this regard. Everyone should be revolutionaries so that we can move forward on this path and continue it in a successful manner. The belief that revolutionaries are only individuals who lived during the time of Imam Rahmatullah Alayh or stood beside him during the time of revolutionary activities is erroneous. If we define a revolutionary person as such, then we old and rusty men are the only revolutionaries left. The revolution belongs to everyone.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy,
because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr. Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Program has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country.
As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people struggle for freedom, and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources, and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon, and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stress that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak.
In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British